طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we take a long look at Palestinian refugee camps, the culture and politics they create, the evolution of shelters built, and in particular the impact of humanitarianism and NGOs on the lives of the inhabitants. Professor Ilana Feldman spoke at Tufts University about her research and the subsequent book she wrote, which focuses on the Palestinian refugee camps. She is introduced by Tufts Professor of Anthropology, Amal Bishara.
And now the fun part of introducing Ilana. Ilana is the Vice Dean at the Elliott School of International Affairs and a Professor of Anthropology, History, and International Affairs at George Washington University. She's a leading scholar on Palestine and refugees, and she's an activist to boot. Being dean and a scholar and having a lifetime of activism is a pretty nice trio. Her research is focused on the Palestinian experience both inside and outside of historic Palestine, examining practices of government, humanitarianism, policing, displacement, and citizenship. She's a leading scholar of humanitarianism, co-editing with Miriam Tichton, In the Name of Humanity, The Government of Threat and Care, and author of the new book, Life Lived in Relief, Humanitarian Predicaments and Palestinian Refugee Politics, which we'll hear about today, which is the 2019 winner of the Fatima Mernissi Book Award Prize from the Middle East Studies Association, and they wrote about it, that the book is a searing look at how the politics of humanitarian aid have trapped Palestinians in a cycle of dependence, even while international politics have halted any viable alternative for Palestinian statehood. Feldman's research illuminates Palestinian dignity and the indignities that they have faced, even as the international community purports to help Palestinians cope with one of the region's greatest humanitarian crises. Ilana is an inspiring figure also in the field of anthropology of state, bureaucracy, policing, and corruption, as the author of Governing Gaza, Bureaucracy, Authority, and the Work of Rule, and Police Encounters, Security and Surveillance in Gaza Under Egyptian Rule. Her work brilliantly integrates archival and ethnographic research with a close attention to multiple kinds of hierarchies, including those that are often overlooked or those that even emerge through her field practice. We were just talking earlier in a smaller group around dichotomies and hierarchies between refugees and non-refugees and what those have meant in different contexts. Her work is built from careful listening to people like retired bureaucrats, refugees, police officers, activists, humanitarian workers, and so she teaches us how to focus on listening to these Palestinians, but she also reminds us of how important it is not to treat Palestine as an exceptional case. Her work grows from more than 25 years of engagement with Palestine, and I was reading something that you wrote or did an interview with Cultural Anthropology in 2017 in which you said that you had guarded hope.
gone.
So we can follow up on whether that's, yes, truly gone in the last 3 years, or whether the historical perspective continues to bring you forward to the present moment. She's written for more public audiences in important publications like Jedaliyah and Middle East Report, and she serves our community of scholars through Middle East Report and many other institutions, organizations. And she also comes from the NOFA Stay Chill School of Anthropology, and all I can say is, I take notes. I introduce Ilana Feldman. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Amal, for bringing me here and for that very, very kind introduction. And thanks to you all for coming out. I'm really delighted to have an opportunity to talk to you about my book. And actually, I'll sort of pause before getting into the more substantive slides with the cover. And I want to note two things, actually. I mean, partly I'm showing you the cover as advertisement for the book, but I also love the cover. And for those of you who have published books, or for those of you who haven't, you might note that, you know, when you're writing a book, you have a lot of control, most control over the content, right? You do the research, you do the writing, but when you get to the cover, the publisher seizes control. They might ask for your input, but they have final authority because they consider it a marketing decision. And many terrible things can happen with covers, and especially when you're working on something like refugees. I had a great deal of concern about what kinds of images might be put on the cover of this book. And so, you know, I tried to really insist. And in any event, I think they did a wonderful job. I think it was a beautiful cover. And it doesn't do any of the things that I was afraid of, which is basically asking people to buy the book through a kind of victim porn of people suffering, that of what you might read in the book. Because I felt like not only do I object to that generically, I felt like that was counter to what I was trying to accomplish in the book. So I note that. So let's get in. So places like Burj Barajne, Jerash, and Wehdet, these are pictures of Palestinian refugee camps where I conducted field work for my book, don't look like refugee camps as camps are commonly imagined. Right? People usually think about camps as a sprawl of tents that are very closely managed by humanitarian actors. And most Palestinian camps did begin as tent encampments in 1948. But as the mass displacement of Palestinians dragged on, first over years and then over decades, they had to evolve. And I should note that this kind of change in the built environment is inevitable in any human settlement that's in existence for 70 years, right? It is not possible for a place not to change, evolve, and meet the different needs of its population. And yet, despite that, you know, seemingly very obvious point, it comes as a surprise to people that refugee camps, like other spaces where people make their lives, have histories. And in some sense, that kind of structure is how I'm thinking about everything in the project in this book. And I often like to note at this point that when I was applying for research grants to fund the research for this work, I had a reviewer from the National Science Foundation, and I got the grant in the end. But one reviewer who said, a project on humanitarianism, very well and good, you know, why not? But why study the pathological case? And so why was the Palestinian case the pathological case that could not be used to tell us anything about humanitarianism as a phenomenon? One, the places where they live don't look like camps. They look just like slums anywhere else. Also, that Palestinians were not refugees because they were never going to be able to return. Now, as I said, other reviewers had a different perspective, and I got the funding. But I actually, you know, I mean, I reacted, not shockingly, very negatively to that comment, both partly because I saw it as a political rather than an intellectual response. But it also actually proved really generative for my thinking, because despite the fact that I think it is wrong, again, both politically and intellectually, and there are a lot of, you know, general thoughts that camps are sort of spaces of stasis, it really pushed me to think about what a camp is, right? Because I was so certain that there was nothing correct about the statement that some place that looks like this is just ipso facto not a camp. But then I had to think about, what is a camp? What makes a camp? How do we think about a camp over time? So even comments that are wrong-headed and trying to get in your way can be very productive for your work. So anyway, so here, these images I said are recent, you know, relatively recent images of what the camps look like now. But if we go back in time to the beginning of Palestinian displacement in 1948, as I said, camps began looking very much like what we would think refugee camps would look like. And so I want to highlight two aspects of this kind of classic image of the camp. One, their ephemerality, right? So the structures themselves themselves are, you know, these are tents. They do not withstand the weather. And this was a problem very early on in the period of Palestinian displacement, where there were storms across the Middle East, and many of the camps, the tents were destroyed. So ephemeral, but also highly ordered. So you can see kind of humanitarian governance in the structure of the placement of the camps. So these are two features that we think of as defining refugee camps. And over time, both of those features in different ways begin to fade away or get reshaped. So two other things, so we're beginning to sort of move forward in time. One, this image of the Khan Yunis camp shows us another way in which refugee camps started. So most of them were tents, but some were repurposed military barracks. And you had that in Gaza, you had that in Lebanon. So there are different ways in which camps start. And then in the Marqa camp, you can kind of see a midpoint in materiality of the camp. So tents are no longer what's being used. These are these kind of prefab shelters, but you can still see that the humanitarian system is structuring the camp, right? It's the layout, you know, is still shows you that this is a highly governed space or spatially governed. But then, you know, as you go over time, all of this begins to fade away, right? As people are living in these spaces, they get, you know, camps cannot grow out, so they grow up and they grow more dense, right? Population grows through population growth, right? There are, of course, over the long period of 70 years, people that move into camps from elsewhere in multiple waves of Palestinian displacement. But really, the most significant reason that camps get more crowded is because generations grow. And people begin to use these spaces in multiple kinds of ways. They use them for commerce, right? They build multi-story shelters. You can see these are pictures from sort of interior to camps in Lebanon. And this is another thing that I want to note about the camp. So one, over time, what becomes most visually prominent is the ways that people are living in them, not the systems that set them up. And also, every camp, you can see resonances from one camp to another across different places where Palestinians live, and of course, even globally where camps are. But camps also have a material connection to the places where they are. So, for example, refugee camps in Lebanon are often, you know, one of the things that you notice about them visually when you're in them are these kind of jerry-rigged electric and water systems, right? Because those things are inadequate. And that's a feature of the camps in Lebanon, but it's partly a feature of the camps in Lebanon because it is a feature of Lebanon. So across the country, there is inadequate electricity and infrastructure systems. So this, you know, there is a connection to the way camps are in particular places, even as they are also connected to each other. And then, you know, looking at camps and things like the sort of visual of the camps, it's just one way into a, you know, being able to think about the long term, right? What happens in displacement over the long term? And this is another way in which I think we need to think about the Palestinian experience. As Amal said, one of the things I'm really interested in, and I think most scholars of Palestine are, is trying to insist that this is not a utterly exceptional, unique condition from which we cannot learn anything, or in the language of NSF, from which we cannot derive generalizable knowledge. So in thinking about displacement, the UNHCR, which is the UN agency that deals with refugees, not Palestinians, the UNHCR estimates that 2/3 of the world's displaced population experience protracted displacement. You cross over into protracted when you've been displaced for 5 years or more. So the Palestinian experience of 70 years of displacement is on one end of a spectrum, right? It is extreme, but it is not utterly unique or distinctive, right? And in fact, protracted displacement is the condition that we need to understand. So I think scholars, practitioners, and publics all need to confront the fact that long-term humanitarian presence is not exceptional. So if we want to understand what humanitarianism is, we have to understand its long-term work, not just its response to crisis. So in my book, I look at the Palestinian refugee experience living with, in relation to, and sometimes against a humanitarian apparatus over 70 years. And in the book, I explore two sets of questions, as I've, I think, already begun to suggest. One set of questions are precisely about humanitarianism. Right, so what happens to humanitarianism as it becomes long-term, right, as it deals with chronic conditions as much as crisis situations? Because even though this is the common condition, it is not comfortable for humanitarian actors to deal with, right? So there's, you know, so I'm trying to understand how is humanitarian purpose challenged? How is it redefined? How are humanitarian mandates and constituencies stretched, reconfigured, and limited over the long term? And then I have a second set of questions about Palestinians. All right, so how do Palestinians who have lived with this apparatus for such a long time pursue their lives and politics? In what ways do humanitarian procedures, discourses, and materials provide tools for, as much as impediments to, making claims and living lives? And so here, again, I want to sort of take stock of something or call your attention to something. In a lot of the scholarly literature on humanitarianism, especially within anthropology, but not only, there's been a great deal of focus on the ways in which humanitarianism is a limiting discourse, a limiting structure, the ways in which it reduces people to the victim label and requires them to occupy a kind of certain way of being in order to be legible for humanitarian aid. And I do not disagree with that, but that is a partial account, because when people live in relation to humanitarian apparatuses, when they live through their categories, they try to do all sorts of things regardless of that fact. And they don't only do those things kind of getting around the humanitarian system, they do those things sometimes right through it. So I'll talk a bit about the ways in which the refugee category itself becomes a means of doing politics. So I'm looking at, in the book, again, both what we can talk about, and people may be familiar with this kind of language of the humanitarian politics of life, right? So this is thinking about the governance of bodies and populations in the management of aid delivery. And then I'm also looking at, and this is what I was sort of just talking about, what I think about as the politics of living, how people live within humanitarian spaces, how they survive and strive within them. So, just to give you a bit of a sense of where I was looking, what I was doing, this is a map of the area of UNRWA operations. UNRWA is the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, and I focused in this book on the area of UNRWA operations. There are displaced Palestinians across the globe, but I was focused on the places where UNRWA works. I was not only looking at UNRWA, but this is the sort of heart of the humanitarian system for Palestinian refugees. And again, I was looking at 7 decades of displacement. When I started the project, I would describe it as being 1948 to the present. You eventually always need an endpoint because you stop doing research. But also, you know, as it turned out, there was kind of a historical change, which was the war in Syria and the massive displacement that ensued from that. That is not really part of this project. There were tentacles of it impacting the places that I was working on. But basically, I end up with a book that is sort of up to 48 up to that. I did archival research in UNRWA archives and the archives of other organizations that have worked with refugees. And then I did field work primarily in 4 refugee camps, Jerash, Wehdat, Bourjibarajne, and Dehesha, in 3 fields of operation. So Jordan, Lebanon, and the West Bank. As Amal noted, I've done a lot of work in Gaza before, so I drew on some of the ethnographic work that I had done there previously. And, you know, I had originally planned to work in Syria, but that became impossible. But I have an archival record that covers these other fields. And in the camps, I interviewed hundreds of people, refugees from multiple generations, and humanitarian workers. And I should note, importantly, that many people are both, right? Most on-the-ground humanitarian workers providing assistance to Palestinian refugees are Palestinian refugees. So when I was thinking about the categories of refugee and humanitarian worker, that is not a demographic distinction. That is a position distinction. And then I observed a number of different humanitarian projects in action. So again, to give you a sense of the kinds of things that I was looking at, I was trying to look at lots of different projects, but also different kinds of projects run by different sorts of organizations. So again, in Borja Barajne, I looked at an MSF, Doctors Without Borders mental health project. And, you know, MSF is one of the, like, big boys of the International Humanitarian Club, one of the major international humanitarian organizations. And at the same time, I was looking at the projects that were being done by locally founded and run NGOs. Similarly, in the Jeddah Gaza camp, I looked at an UNRWA managed EU-funded project, and there are all sorts of projects like that where they're sort of run by one organization, donors come from elsewhere. And also the Islamic Center is a Muslim Brotherhood supported center. So I was trying to get even as UNRWA is the central axis for this book, because they are present basically in all fields in all decades, I wanted to understand something about humanitarian operations that was not just about this agency. And even as I'm interested in some of the distinctions between these organizations, what is notable to me is that, you know, extremely secular MSF, self-defined, you know, religious, you know, Islamic Center, have operations that are similar in lots of ways. So, you know, the differences among them don't necessarily break down along what we would think of as, you know, Western, you know, local, religious, secular. So, in looking at the intersection of the politics of life and the politics of living, I develop several lines of argument in the book, and I will try to just take you through them. So one, you know, back to thinking about what is humanitarianism over this long period. I talk about it as punctuated humanitarianism. And what do I mean by that? I'm trying to capture the move from what I think about as the humanitarian situation, right, the crisis moment that generates a response, and the humanitarian condition, which is as things kind of ebb into a kind of stasis, but are no less defined by the circumstances that led to humanitarian presence and where people still have need, but it's not an immediate threat to life often. So I'm looking at the move over time between the chronic and the crisis, and the challenge of what also happens of moving between the two. Because even as we can describe kind of generally a trajectory over seven decades of a move from crisis to chronic, right? Crisis in 1948, chronic in 1960. We see in different moments in different places regular eruptions of crisis. 1967, 1970, 1987, 1982, where, you know, depending on where you're looking. And those re-eruptions of crisis require a different kind of humanitarian response. So the same organizations have to move back and forth between what it is that they are doing. So I'm trying to capture, and thinking about it as punctuated, I'm trying to capture something about these shifting rhythms of change, where you have sort of kind of a slow and imperceptible change, changes that are decided, you know, in the course of meetings in headquarters that eventually find their way through memos into the field, that eventually somebody gets a different kind of rations allotment, to things that happen immediately when there is a war and donors pour money in and people need lots of rations all of a sudden. And then I'm also trying to capture the effects that they have on people and the disruptions that they produce. And again, you know, I'm looking at both providers and recipients here. For providers, actually, and this may not be surprising, humanitarian actors are energized by emergency, right? It does not mean that they are happy when there's a crisis, but they know what to do. They are trained to alleviate suffering and save lives. They are very uncertain about what to do in chronic conditions, when it's not clear either that they can have an impact on somebody's life or what their mandate is to respond to, say, you know, the illnesses that happen in old age. Also, providers are extremely frustrated by the cycles of repeated destruction, right? So if you think about Gaza over the last decade, where there have been three series of attacks on the area, of course, the residents of Gaza suffer enormously. And humanitarian agencies, after each one of these conflicts, go and see what's left of the school that we just rehabbed. Do we start again, right? And so this is enormously frustrating and more than frustrating for people. For recipients, these different rhythms mean that people move in and out of different relationships to the humanitarian apparatus, which is itself changing, right? So again, I also want to emphasize that it's not so much a circle, right, from crisis back to chronic and back again, as more like a wave, because each time you return to a crisis moment that generates a renewed humanitarian response, the humanitarian system is a little bit different than the last time, right? There's a different set of best practices. So it's never quite the same thing again. But people move in and out of different relationships to it. So in the midst of violence, which is a moment of heightened humanitarian awareness, sometimes humanitarians can't get to people, right? And in chronic conditions, they often can't do very much for them. So just to kind of concretize some of these changes, so this is just one instance of a sort of return to crisis over the long history of Palestinian displacement. So in 1970, this went on for several years, but there, you know, for people who are not familiar with the history, there was a conflict between Palestinians, the PLO, and the Jordanian government. And Palestinian refugee camps, a number of them were right at the center of this conflict and suffered very extreme destruction. So this is the Wehdat camp, which I showed you a picture of before, in the aftermath of that destruction. And here is the humanitarian response to what people are living with. But when we think about, like, just a few years prior to this, you know, 1965, of course, 1967 was another crisis moment. But prior to 1970, you would have had a moment where people were kind of, again, ebbing into the chronic, right? Rations were being pulled back. People are finding work. But these moments of crisis require and enable a renewed kind of response. So then, I'm also... Oh, yes.
Can you really describe in more detail what happened to the refugee camps during the last weekend?
There was fighting between Palestinian guerrilla fighters and the Jordanian military, and many of those fighters were situated in the camp. So there was fighting in and around the camps, and that is the cause of the destruction. Black September is a subject in which it is very few people want to talk about in Jordan. Very few Palestinians want to talk about because it remains a source of a great deal of vulnerability. I do know a PhD student who's working on this right at the moment because there's a lot that we don't know, or I don't know. People know, right? The people who lived through it know it, but there's a lot that I don't know in a granular way about what people's experiences were during that time. But it would come up, you know, when I was doing interviews in Jordan, for example, I did not ask questions about that for quite deliberately, even though I would love to know about it because it is a source of vulnerability. But even without asking questions, it would kind of come up sometimes for some people around a conversation that we were having. So I remember, you know, then either my father was away or we were stuck at home because of this fighting. I don't know. That sort of doesn't exactly answer your question, but it explains some of the limits to talking about it. All right, so I want to think about this question of what is Palestinian politics in this context. And I should say, and maybe this speaks also a little bit there's multiple ways in which Palestinians are political. I think people are very familiar. You know, organized militant movements is one way of being political. Political movements like the PLO and the many factions within the PLO is another structuring organization for Palestinian politics. A lot of Palestinian politics takes place in a register and in a realm that does not have anything to do with humanitarianism, right? Isn't using that language or responding to it. What I am interested in this context is not so much organized politics, the things that people are doing intersects with it, but the ways in which people on the ground, as they're going about their lives, are trying to make political claims for themselves. And I am also specifically interested in the ways in which people are doing politics in, through, and in relation to humanitarianism. So I just, I want to emphasize that I am not describing the fullness of what it is to be political as a Palestinian or in the Palestinian context, but I'm very interested in trying to shed light on politics within this space that we think of as devoid of politics, and certainly which is designed to push politics to the side for the particular purpose of saving lives, right? It's not just a willy-nilly, we're not interested in politics, it doesn't belong here. It's a, we need to hold it to the side in order to be able to accomplish this fundamental task. But the people who are recipients of that aid, they want the aid, but they're not willing to make those divisions very often. And I use the term of discordant politics to capture what I see as the multiplicities of refugee politics, right? That it takes place in multiple registers with multiple aims and multiple tactics. And also what I'm trying to capture the real tensions among them, right? So it's not just that there's lots of different political perspectives or lots of different kinds of political aims, but that people really feel those aims to be in tension. So their Palestinian refugees pursue a politics of suffering, which is something we might expect for refugees, but also a politics of aspiration, of existence, and of refusal. And they insist that refugees are, on the one hand, a suffering subject, but also refugees are a rights-bearing category. They insist on service delivery as a matter of justice, and they pursue a politics in multiple temporalities. A near and distant future. Near, like, can the life of my children be better tomorrow? And more distant, will we return to Palestine at some point? And similarly, close and far places. The camp as a space in which you have political claims, and Palestine as a space about which you have political claims. And also goals of different grandeur. Again, liberation versus improvement. And this politics is sometimes in tension with Palestinian nationalist movements, who are more comfortable in the register of national liberation than the register of camp improvement, and also in confrontation with host countries, who are, as you can imagine, very uncomfortable with the political expression of refugees. They make demands of the international community for recognition as refugees and recognition as a political community. And they make demands of themselves and of their community to live as good Palestinian subjects. And as I said, all of these demands are genuinely in conflict, but also always persist together. And this is an image, so most of the images that I have here are from the UNRWA archives. I think I have one on here that's from the American Friends Service Committee archives. But I feel like this image in some ways captures some of that discordant politics. So for people who are familiar with Palestinian political iconography will be very familiar with the image of the key, right? And that's the key is keys to people's homes that they took when they left Palestine and now has been, as a symbolic gesture. These are different keys. These are keys, this is the Aida camp, actually. These are keys that people were getting to shelters that were being built to move them from tents into shelters. So again, there is a way in which moving from a tent to a shelter is to stand against a certain politics of insisting upon return and insisting that you will not settle where you are. But there is another way in which having a better place to live and shelter your children is a demand for recognition of your needs now and saying, and this is something that I heard everywhere that I did research, that I deserve, and my children deserve, a better life now, rights to work, better water, safe place to live, and that does not in any way stand against the claims that I have for restitution for my lost property and our national claims to liberation. But the fact that people hold them together does not mean that they are not, that there is not this tension. So this is what part of what I'm trying to investigate here. And a clear place in which you can see that is, as I already kind of intimated, is the refugee category itself. So there is a perhaps an irony in the fact, or certainly something notable in the fact that a non-political humanitarian category, right? The refugee is a category that is specifically created as a humanitarian category to make people eligible for certain protections and assistance. So this non-political humanitarian category becomes a site of politics, and the refugee is and becomes a political subject. And in this way, I think that refugee politics doesn't only, Palestinian refugee politics is important for Palestinians making political claims, but it has a broader political significance than that. It also challenges existing frameworks for political contestation. Specifically, I think what it does is expands the grounds on which people make claims within a political space and opens up the categories of people who can claim to have standing for making such claims. So let me explain what I mean there. So in the nation state, the classic category for standing is the citizen, right? So you have to, when somebody's saying, I deserve something, I want something, I have the right to something, a question is, who are you to claim this right? And so a citizen of a country says, I claim this right as a citizen. I have that right as a citizen. Refugee politics invites other people in. It says not only that category, other categories by virtue of other mechanisms. And so I think the aim of refugee politics is not only that refugees be recognized as political actors, right? It's not just that people continue to be political while they're also refugees, but that the category itself be understood as world-forming, right? You can generate political ideas from within the category. The category itself has a political import. And therefore, refugee articulations of possibility do not always and only express themselves as an exit strategy. And again, I think this is an important feature of Palestinian refugee politics, but not only. So what does that mean, right? So in some sense, the ideal, the ultimate aim of Palestinian politics, generally in refugee politics, specifically, is to exit that category, is to end displacement, resolve the situation, have liberation. But that is not the only register, right? People do their politics as refugees and want recognition within that category for certain things. And so displaced persons dwell with and within this category as they enact community, press claims, and experience futurity. So even as they can't always affect a radical change in the world in which they live, the insistence that the refugee is a political subject as a refugee, I think, makes a significant change in how the political field is understood. And I want to turn, and I will try to begin to move towards conclusion, but I want to turn to just talk a little bit about some of the forms of that refugee politics takes. Because refugees act politically within the category in lots of different ways, right, and take lots of different kinds of actions to change their present and future conditions. People engage in protests and petitions for better services and more opportunity. And they also make changes to shelters and camps without waiting for assistance and permission, right? You saw the images that I showed at the beginning. Those changes in camps are in some sense inevitable, but they're inevitable because people do them, because they say, I need more space, I'm going to make it happen. This image, which is actually, this one is from the American Friends Service Committee archives. I show it partly because of the caption that there is in the archives, which is, the image is captioned as dealing with a riot. Does not look very much like a riot. But what it points to, and this is also evident in the archival record of all different kinds of organizations, is right from the beginning, so this is like 1949, people insist on better better rations, more rations, linking humanitarian assistance to their political claims. These things don't just happen over time as political parties get established, as new leaders get developed, as people begin to come to terms. They start doing it immediately. And so I think that is an important thing that we need to sort of recognize, that politics, of course, it changes over time, and it does get more organized, but it takes place even in the moments of greatest crisis. And then, in addition to doing all of these kinds of things, people make all sorts of rights claims. And I'm interested here in the kinds of rights claims they're making kind of in relation to humanitarianism. So one, people claim a right to humanitarianism. And they argue specifically that aid is not charity, but an obligation of the international community. And this is something that you hear from everybody, even as, I mean, people have very complicated feelings about UNRWA, and this may be something that we can talk about in questions, but one thing that you hear repeatedly is that UNRWA specifically, and here it is somewhat, they view UNRWA somewhat differently than other international organizations, because UNRWA is only partially an international organization, but UNRWA is viewed as a recognition of international responsibility for the Palestinian plight and obligation to help resolve it. So along with the right to humanitarianism, people also insist on their right to humanitarian rights. Now, of course, what such rights are and can be is very unsettled. There is a field of international humanitarian law that specifies certain rights for displaced persons, most fundamentally, perhaps, the right of non-refoulement, the right not to be returned to a circumstance in which you are in danger, the right to protection. And Palestinians have, UNRWA, when it was established, did not have a protection mandate. And again, we can get into some of the specificities of the agency later, but it was a service agency without a protection mandate. And partly as a result of refugee insistence over the years, there were multiple factors, but refugee insistence has been key, UNRWA now recognizes, claims a protection mandate and tries to enact it. Hard to do, but the agency has changed because of people's insistence. People also try to insist on humanitarian rights kind of beyond those limited ones which are codified, including the right not to be further displaced, but also kind of an insistence that UNRWA serve in a representative function for Palestinians on an international stage. And this is a call that is very difficult for UNRWA to take up as an agency that is specifically designed as to be impartial, neutral, non-political as a humanitarian organization. But a lot of the work of claiming Palestinian existence and Palestinian rights takes place in conversation with these humanitarian agencies and organizations that exist in an uncomfortable relationship to those claims. So I want to end by just talking a little bit about the way that some refugees experience these things. So doing politics within the refugee category often means both claiming and disavowing it. So, for example, Omar, who is a resident of Dehesha, which is a camp especially known for its political and social activism, reflected on the contradiction of the refugee category. He told me, refugee means you are a person who lacks a lot of things regarding your identity or connected to your original identity. But practically, in daily life, currently the Palestinian refugee is one of the most active people in the society. And Abu Akram, also from Dehesha, emphasized the importance of activating the political potential of the refugee condition when he said, some refugees were upset by the word refugee. Some people did not realize the meaning of the word. In fact, I am proud of being a refugee. And the reason is, I'm a refugee, but I'm waiting for return and I work for return. I became a refugee by force and not by choice. Becoming a refugee to protect yourself and get ready for returning, this is not a flaw. So I'm a refugee in this sense. So part of the political potential of the refugee category lies precisely in continuing to assert that status. And of course, this continued assertion is no easy task. The difficulties of many people's lives work against it. So Feruz, a middle-aged mother of four who was born and raised in the Jeddah camp, worried to me about her children. And she often said to me, she was like, I don't know how much they can bear because I can see that they cannot take the life of refugees. So she would say, her generation, things were hard, but we could handle it. We could bear up being refugees, but they can't. And she also worried about them politically, about what sort of political subjects they would be. And she saw a difference between her two oldest boys. Of the eldest, she told me, if he gets full rights in Jordan, I'm sure he will forget everything called Palestine. But my second, if he gets all the rights in this country, he will still demand Palestine. I don't know why, although both were raised up the same way, I don't know why this one has this mentality and the other has another mentality. And her account reflects patterns and anxieties that I heard throughout my research. So again, it's not just that Palestinian politics is discordant, but in some sense, the experience of being a Palestinian refugee is necessarily discordant. But throughout, it is remarkable that after over seven decades, people have not only continued to assert and live as political subjects, but have continued to persist in maintaining their existence. And I think that I will conclude there. Thank you all very much.
You have been listening to Professor Ilana Feldman speaking at Tufts University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.